The Guardian.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition, David Cameron's threat to block EU reforms branded economic insanity. Some surprising facts about hedgehogs. And in our audiobook review, we look at feminist audiobooks by Germaine Greer and Natasha Walter. To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Film Show on the cusp of the new year. Hopes are high, life's worth living, and our hearts are full of song. Please don't let life kill the dream that we dreamers are dreaming, because, well, that would be sad. Manning the barricades on this week's show, Josh Brolin and Sean Penn go to war in the LA Noir gangster squad. Gilded Youth runs aground in the Irish drama What Richard Did, and Jiro dreams of sushi in the acclaimed documentary about an octogenarian restaurateur. But we begin with Les Misérables, a dream for some, a nightmare for others. It's Tom Hooper's screen adaptation of the stage adaptation of Victor Hugo's novel about romance and revolution in 19th century France. And if you like your emotions big and your prostitutes singing, then here's your horn of plenty.
Yes, it's true, there's a child and the child is my daughter. And her father abandoned us, leaving us flat. Now she lives with an innkeeper man and his wife, and I pay for the child. What's the matter with that?
At the end of the day, she'll be nothing but trouble. And there's trouble for all, and there's trouble for one.
Les Misérables is a teeming theatrical pageant of torment and oppression, love and loss, all played out in song as it moves from 1815 to 1823 to 1832. Hugh Jackman is the resolute fugitive, hounded by Russell Crowe's ruthless lawman, while Anne Hathaway becomes a prostitute by the city gates. Elsewhere, there's Helena Bonham Carter and Sacha Baron Cohen as innkeepers, Eddie Redmayne as a flag-waving firebrand, and more beggars and thieves than you can shake a crutch at.
She's been laughing at you while she's having a mess.
She's in nothing but trouble again and again.
You must sack her
today. Sack her girl today.
Right, my girl. On your way.
I'm pleased to be joined now by The Guardian's very own Marius and Cosette. It's Peter Bradshaw and Catherine Short. Peter, there's a lot of Oscar talk about this film. Can you see why?
Yes, I think I can. I can only say that if you only see one film endorsing left-wing violence this year, then it has to be Les Misérables, really. It's an extraordinary film in a way. It's bizarre. I have to say, I don't think I'm ever going to love it the way that its fans love it. I have a kind of residual sense of scepticism or agnosticism and a sense of the absurdity, the bat squeak of absurdity in this film. But it's very good. I mean, Hugh Jackman gives a performance of very great intelligence and dignity, especially in the opening act. And I can hardly believe I'm saying this. I thought Russell Crowe was very good,
actually.
It was the very fact that he was singing that gave him a kind of tenderness and vulnerability.
Mm. You're saying that basically his ineptitude gave his character a nuance that wasn't otherwise
there.
No,
I don't think I am saying that. I don't think he was inept as a singer at all. I think he was actually a rather good singer, unexpectedly good. I mean, I think the whole experiment of live on-set singing, recorded live on set, as I understand it, using just a pianist with tiny earpieces for all the actors, and then the orchestral score dubbed in later on. That's all worked very, very well.
Catherine, you've seen the original stage production of this, which suggests to me that you're a big fan.
Does it? You don't know me very well. I like musicals, and that's the disclaimer. And I did pay my own money to go and see it on stage, and I took my own mother.
it's starting to sound rather poignant in itself.
And I will sing soon.
Yes.
But I didn't massively go for it. But I'm not a hater. However, I did ultimately, I suppose, come down on the side of quite hating this, very much wanting it to stop, almost as soon as it started. Sorry about that. I mean, it is, you know, there are, I mean, it's impressive logistically in the sense that doing a big shop is impressive logistically. However, it didn't ring true at any moment for me. I just didn't get it. I don't, you know, a lot of the big films this year have got a sort of quite an obvious political message. So Lincoln suggests that slavery is bad, and so does Django. And you know, it's difficult not to sort of think, well, it's probably got something there. Here, what the hell are we meant to be protesting against?
Yeah, it's utterly ahistorical, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, I mean, just, oh, OK, so a bad cop is bad. Well, yeah, you know, and oh dear, poverty is sad.
What I responded to was the sheer melodramatic bizarreness of it. It's so consistent and has such an inconsistent intensity that I ended up admiring it. I mean, I know exactly what Catherine means, and Catherine has already made the excellent point that Anne Hathaway's massive Subo turn singing I Dreamed a Dream in extreme close-up, which has been greeted with adjectives more appropriate to the Sistine Chapel ceiling, to be honest with you, is a little absurd because she has a sort of Marie Antoinette look about her, to be honest with you. And considering that she's supposed to have her teeth knocked out to sell to a street dentist, this turns out to mean just her back teeth. Her front teeth are all there, and they're dazzlingly white, incidentally. So there are moments of, I think, absurdity. Certainly,
that's
true. I
thought the whole thing was absurd.
Oh yes, it is a little bit absurd, but I think it's brilliant in its absurdity.
No, it's. I mean, I think I probably have a prejudice against musicals anyway. It's almost like doing this great kind of sweeping epic historical drama with sock puppets, and there's no reason why it can't work. But it's setting the bar really high, and there is nothing here. Considering it's about heartbreak and death and betrayal and tragedy, there wasn't any part of it that moved me remotely.
I'm not sure I was moved, but I was quite excited and thrilled in a bizarre way, like watching a very long and strange bad dream. As I say, I'm not sure that those are the emotions that Tim Bevan and Eric Fellner want. But nevertheless, I did respond to it. It did have something. There are lots of other middleweight, bland films out there that don't have half the voltage of this film. And I think even though part of me wants to sort of slag it off and take the mickey a little bit, and I think there are bits of it which do need to be slagged off, I think you've got to respect the sheer kind of resonance and electricity of the film.
Now, prisoner 24601, your time is up and your parole's begun. You know what that means.
Yes, he's free.
No. Follow to the letter your itinerary. This badge of shame will show it till you die. It warns you're a dangerous man.
Stole a loaf of bread. My sister's child was close to death. We were starving.
You'll starve again unless you learn the meaning of the law.
Know the meaning of those 19 years. A slave of the law.
Les Mis there, and they won't stop singing until the lights go up. Rest assured that there's no such antics in Gangster Squad, a brawny tale of G-men and crooks in post-war LA. We sat down to talk to the film's stars, Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone and Josh Brolin.
Who is he?
It's in the air! Come on!
I don't think so. $10 says this guy ain't even healed.
I'll take that bet.
Yeah. Let's come over here and find out. Bang. As violent as it is, there's an idea of innocence back then, especially in talking to my father about it, and intrinsically feeling like there was more of an innocence back then for him. It was nice to be able to relive that.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Connor. It won't ever happen again. I swear to God.
You're talking to God, so you might as well swear to me.
The Tommy gun is a bit of a sore issue for me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tell me why.
Well, I thought I was going to get to have one. I just thought gangster movie, Tommy gun, it's a no-brainer. But, you know, in order to make every character different, everyone got their own different kind of gun.
So you feel that you were slighted in some way?
I mean, you said it, not me, but I you know, I'm not going to disagree with you.
Let's see, you're not quite big enough to be a Shylock. I give up. What's your racket, handsome?
It was also interesting to kind of rationalize why a woman would want to be involved with such a dangerous man.
And then, on top of that, get involved with someone else. There's some attention-seeking thing going on with her. And a self-sabotage-y thing.
Get low! Get low! Get low!
You can't shoot me. You're a cop.
Not anymore.
Thank God for this movie, because it made me stop smoking. We were smoking like filterless cigarettes, and you'd have to smoke like a cigarette every take. So I ended up smoking like sometimes like 3 packs a day.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
Well, that's one way of giving up, I suppose.
Yeah, it's the kind of the best way to quit. Do a gangster movie.
These guys are a special brand. A hard case is not interested in money. Cop is not for sales like a dog with rabies. There's no medicine for it. You just gotta put them down.
Catherine, bearing in mind that this is obviously a load of ropey old rubbish, I quite enjoyed this.
Did you really?
I did.
You see, yeah.
I enjoy it.
I mean, it's one of those films, isn't it? Because, you know, this time last year, or 6 months ago even, you were thinking, oh, that looks really promising. That's a big Oscar film there. And then it had to do the reshoot because of the Aurora thing and all that. And still I'm sort of thinking, oh, I wonder, you know, out in January, maybe it's a contender. And then you see it and you think, oh, yeah, really isn't, is it? I mean, it's really... It's really quite bad, surprisingly bad. And Sean Penn is, it's really bad, isn't it? And he's one of
Sean Penn, we should point out, plays Mickey Cohen, the big Jewish gangster who's running LA. Yeah. And it's a wildly over-the-top, almost grotesque performance.
It's borderline, isn't it? And it's one of those films that you're tempted to say, well, it's very panto, but it's slightly more than panto. It's kind of, it's almost spoof.
Peter, join me in my grudging affection.
I have a grudging affection for this film. I know what you mean about Sean Penn. He's an outrageous ham. He's just like a huge big gun. And once you wheel him in and light the touch paper, then you better step back and put your hands over your ears, because he's going to go off deafeningly. In what direction, God alone knows. I've got a soft spot for him. I like his kind of hammy and mad performances. I quite enjoyed his hammy and mad performances, Mickey Cohen. And I did quite... I know what you mean. There is a kind of Lieutenant Frank Drebin feel to this film. And some of the dialogue, the kind of spoof, pastiche 1940s dialogue, especially when Emma Stone says, well, I'm going to go and bend my elbow while you guys bend your ears. What the hell is she talking about? But it is quite enjoyable. It's very slick. It's very shallow.
Cut price untouchables, isn't it?
It's very cut price unofficial. It's not really noir. I mean, you and I have referred to it as noir in various, but it's a world away from James Ellroy. I mean, James Ellroy had a serious sense of investigating police corruption and ambiguity. There's nothing like that here.
We're saying that it's verging on parody, but the director's best known film, of course, is Zombieland, which went for the whole parody style very successfully. What was he thinking of here, do you think, Catherine?
I don't know, because I mean the violence is treated in a similar way than it is in Zombieland, but
lots of slow-mo, blood jetting.
Yeah, and people being ripped apart by chains, which actually it's not very nice. It's not very funny in this.
No, it's completely
it's just
unfunny.
Unpleasant.
Weirdly, the violence is front-loaded in the film. I think the really nasty scenes are at the very beginning. Oddly, as it goes on, there's less and less violence, and in a way it becomes a little bit more mainstream. But if, for those of us who've watched his earlier movies, his much more personal and funny movies, like this is a huge disappointment, really, because it could have been done by anybody. And it's a shame, because I'm a bit of a fan of Ruben Fleischer.
Hey, we got a message from Mr. Cohen.
Look, it just seems like the lady doesn't want to talk to you.
Well, lady, she's just one of Mickey's pro skirts there, pal.
Where is it?
Where is it?
No. What is that? Is that your message for her? Is that acid? Huh?
Come on.
I swear to God, if I ever see you near her again, I'll kill you.
Okay.
Good.
No! 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 Cut!
The Honest Cops of Gangster Squad. Let's now move from the mean streets of LA to the leafy suburbs of Dublin in What Richard Did. A coming-of-age tale with a difference.
Look what the tide washed in.
Hey, Mum.
Did you enjoy the pre-gaff?
Yeah, can't complain.
Hello. Beautiful son.
Hey, old dad.
Ah, to be Richard. Young, good-looking, middle-class, and surrounded by a gaggle of adoring disciples. The future's so bright he's got to wear shades. That is, until an altercation at a house party throws the teenager's life into crisis and forces him to choose between the high road or damnation.
Cheers, Peter. I've only spent the last 6 years teaching him to be a winner.
Well, success is good. I like success.
Failure's not an option now, right, Pat?
That's it.
Well, you're right. Failure's not an option. It's a certainty.
Oh, come on.
Well, it is at some point for most people. I mean, it makes them human. True.
Peter, this is directed by Lenny Abramson, who made Adam and Paul and Garage, which are both terrific films, but kind of worked under the radar a bit. He hasn't quite broken through.
Yes, he still hasn't quite. I think this is up to radar level without quite breaking through yet. I think he deserves to. I think Lenny Abramson is one of the most interesting European film directors working right at the moment. And what Richard did is a really, really interesting, resonant drama which really stayed with me, working very interestingly with a young cast who are all give great performances. What I find fascinating about this movie is that it belongs to two separate traditions. It belongs in a way partly to the American teen noir tradition of a bunch of well-bred, well-off teenagers who've maybe got something to hide, like the sort of Heathers thing, or a European tradition of something like Thomas Vinterberg, of a group dysfunction.
Yeah, a community in crisis.
A community in crisis. And interestingly, his dad, the boy's dad, is played by Lars Mikkelsen, who's the brother of Mads Mikkelsen from Vinterberg's The Hunt. It's really, really well done, really interesting, uncliched view of modern Ireland.
It's uncliched, but it's quite high concept, isn't it, in terms of the actual plot twist and the dilemma at the heart of the film.
It is, and it's neat like that. But in that way, it's a sort of slightly strange... It's odd because it's a harder sell. I mean, I loved Garage because it was particularly, as well as Adam and Paul, because it was under the radar, because it was grotty, because it dealt with people who were struggling. This, you know, as Peter says, superficially, it's so glossy, it's so kind of Melrose Place, that it's strange, it's harder to get into. And so it does make the achievement even greater, that you do end up caring, you do end up sympathising, and you do end up sort of torn in similar ways. For me, it's not quite as good as Garage, actually. It felt more disposable somehow. But it is fantastically good, I think.
I know you're all hurting at the moment. But we're a team, and teams pull together through the tough times. And I know you're all missing Connor, and you're all angry about what happened to him. But for now, let's just take a moment to say goodbye to a friend and a great teammate. Goodbye to Connor.
It's Connor.
A fine performance from Jack Rayner in What Richard Did. And now, an altogether different kettle of fish. It's Jiro Dreams of Sushi. If you have bags of money and patience in abundance, you may wish to book a stool at Jiro Ono's 3 Michelin-starred restaurant over in Tokyo. David Gelb's quiet, tender documentary charts its subject's rise from poverty and zen-like mastery over a world of cold fish. Just don't bring your own ketchup. Catherine, a great advert for his restaurant, this film.
It is, and it's a strange film in that way because, you know, it's an incredibly expensive restaurant to eat there. You have to have a lot of
300 quid minimum charge, isn't it?
Each, plus sake. In fact, I think it's more like 215 or something. It's $300.
$300.
A small change. But anyway, it's strange because you have this incredibly expensive restaurant and you have quite luxy production on this film. It's very sort of slathered in soundtrack and it's quite sort of posh, the film. And yet this incredibly austere subject matter. It's basically just cutting up fish. Mm. And the guy is very kind of, you know, his background is one of amazing poverty, really. So I'm slightly disappointed in a way at the sort of clash between those two worlds in the film, which I didn't think sort of led to anything interesting. It was just a clash.
What I found interesting was the father-son dynamic. It almost seemed to be that was the real meat of this picture.
I think another sort of film would have investigated that a lot more closely and perhaps a little less respectfully than this film does. I thought it was an interesting movie. I got the impression that I was watching a very good advert for a very, very expensive restaurant, like the recent movie El Bulli, Cooking in Progress. I thought it was great. I think it's very interesting to have sushi return to us as something mysterious and, dare I say, exotic, or at any rate, something precious and wonderful. I don't want to use that awful word foodie in connection with this film, that terrible word, but I've got a feeling that that is the market that it's aimed at, this awful foodie market. But there's a lot to take in here, and it is interesting.
You say that suggests that it might be sort of porn for posh people, but it also kind of glosses over the ecological consequences of gobbling too much sushi, doesn't it?
Completely, yeah. And it, and the sort of any conception of cruelty or anything, you know, you get quite a lot of kind of sense of that when you're, you know, some of the shots. And, you know, the sort of weirdness of it. I mean, it's all kind of, it's sacramental and it's wonderful and it's traditional and respectful. But actually, massaging a dying octopus for 40 minutes, quite weird. I'm not sure
it's
that's
a living.
Right.
Yeah, and we've all done it.
We've all.
Let's face it. We've all caressed the odd dying octopus.
That's Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And if you like the prospect of sushi and dreaming, then the film is actually screening in its entirety on the Guardian film site. As for us, we've cleaned our plates and moved on to the coffee. My thanks to Peter Bradshaw and Catherine Shord. Happy New Year. We'll see you next week.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, David Cameron's threat to block EU reforms branded economic insanity. Some surprising facts about hedgehogs. And in our audiobook review, we look at feminist audiobooks by Germaine Greer and Natasha Walter. To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.